Welcome to the Women and Money Cafe. I'm your host, Julie Flynn, independent financial advisor and financial coach. And this is the weekly money podcast for women by women, exploring the practical and emotional side of money. Welcome back to this episode of the Women and Money Cafe. Okay, if you listened to episode 74, then you'll know that we had Catherine Knowles on. And Catherine was talking to us about everything you need to know about life cover. Now, if you've listened, you'll know that Catherine is like incredibly knowledgeable when it comes to all things protection. She's just the go-to person for all those financial advisors. So it made sense to get Catherine back on the show to talk about something that I think is really important that some of you might not even know exists. Or if you do know it exists, you're just like, I don't know enough about it to know if that's something I should be doing. And it's income protection. So I'm delighted to welcome you back into the cafe, Catherine.
Hi, lovely to be back again. Thank you.
All right. And I've got my co-host with me today, Michelle.
Morning, Judy.
Hello. All right. So here we are, all sitting comfy on the sofa. Let's have a good old chat about income protection. So, Catherine, do you want to kick us off by just sort of giving us a broad outline of what it is?
Yeah, income protection is essentially what it says it is in many ways, but there can be some confusion over it as well. So with income protection, what you're doing is you're insuring part of your gross income each month up to a certain age. Now, what people will sometimes think is income protection is unemployment cover. So like if you made redundant, and it doesn't usually cover that. I'm not saying it doesn't ever, but the majority of actual income protection policies don't do that. There is a separate insurance that does do that. But income protection is all about your inability to work due to you being ill. And it's really, really, it's one of the best income, best insurance policies out there because you can tweak it and build it in so many ways. But that also makes it one of the most complicated when people are looking at it. So you can have, you know, usually, so you can do it personally. You can set it up for businesses as well, and that can change things a bit. But if I look, talk about it probably more in the personal sense, so that's where you set it up for yourself to insure your own money. You're usually going to be insuring around 65%, 70% of your gross income. Now, do bear in mind with your gross income that we do need to be careful if there's a certain amount that's maybe commission or bonus based, because we need to just, we don't want to underinsure ourselves in some ways, but we also don't want to overinsure ourselves. So shall I just give a really quick example of that, just to sort of like,
yeah.
So I know that I've just talked a little bit jargony there. So let's say, I can't do the maths too well in my head, so just forgive me while I try and do this. I'm trying to think of something that's like 60% of something. But let's say, to say there's £30,000. You get £30,000 a year, and actually £5,000 of that is bonus. So you'll be insuring yourself probably for £30,000 a year, and you'll do the maximum probably based upon £30,000. But if you don't get a bonus the next year, or it's a lot less, then what will have happened is you've paid in a sense for 30,000, but you actually got less money than that. So the amount the insurer might pay you might be a little bit less than what you were expecting. So if you do have any kind of fluctuating income, it's really important to just be on top of keeping an eye on how much you're insured for. If it's consistently lower, you might want to just change how you've sort of set the policy up. But if it's higher, then you might want to increase it as well. Does that make sense? Have I gone a bit too jargony?
Nope, it did make sense. It did make sense.
So we would do that. So you would do, ideally, I always say to people when I'm advising on income protection, I'm going to go for the all singing, all dancing version, because it's much better to look at the absolute best of the best that we can get and then bring it backwards and tweak it if it's not within the price that people want. And what's quite surprising is I think a lot of people think that income protection is phenomenally more expensive than what it is. I think I saw some statistics where a lot of people expect it to be about four times the price of what it actually is. So it can really surprise people as to that it isn't anywhere near where they're expecting it to be. So there is some really funny things that can happen with it that can massively change the price. And I've got a really, really good example for you. So a really key thing to look at, when I'm saying I do the all singing, all dancing, I say to people, I'm doing the all singing, all dancing, but the cheapest version of the all singing, all dancing, in a sense. Let's just go, you know, so playing about with the wording here a little bit. But I always say to people as well, I completely appreciate that you might do research yourself as well, because why wouldn't you? Why wouldn't you try and have a look? You know, I'm saying one thing to you, but it's perfectly natural to just have a quick look yourself. And they will absolutely see a cheaper price than what I'm saying to them. So I'm just very open from the start, because there are so many ways that change the pricing. So the amount of money per month that you're getting, how quickly the money kicks in, because it usually doesn't kick in from the first day that you're unable to work. It can do sometimes, but it's usually at least 4 weeks. It can be anywhere up to 12 months before the money kicks in. It can go up to age 68, 70, 55, 60, whatever you choose it to be. And with any of these things, the more money that you're insuring, the quicker you're going to get the money, the longer the age is that you're going to have it, the more expensive it is. So there's lots of ways. But then there's some extra things that make it very, very complicated. So with income protection, you often get the premiums in four different ways. And do bear with me, because again, I'm so sorry. It's full jargon. We do have a massive issue with jargon in our industry. But the first one is guaranteed premiums. So that means if I say to you it's £30 now, it's £30 forever. It's not going to change. That's it. It could be guaranteed age costed. And these aren't always easy to see. So it's really important to check this. And really, you have to be so, so specific about the premiums when you're getting this advice or looking yourself. So age costed guaranteed means, sorry, my dog's just suddenly wandered into the background. Hopefully he won't start barking. No one's going to deliver anything as far as I'm concerned. So age costed means that it will increase each year as you get older, but it's guaranteed to increase at a certain rate. So you know, right, I'm 35 now and it's costing me £25 a month. At 36, it's going to cost me £25.20 a month. So we can plot it as to how much it's going to be all the way up to retirement. We then have some different ones, which are a bit unusual. So we have reviewable, which means that each year the insurer reviews the premiums and they might stay the same or they might change. I think if they are going to change, they're more likely to go up than come down. So it is sort of that kind of a little bit of a risk there. And then we have reviewable age costed, which means, again, it is guaranteed to increase each year as you get older and the premiums will also be reviewed at the same time. So when we're looking at income protection with some of these insurers, some of the policies, we've got all these different options. And then on top of that, four different ways that the premiums can be worked out. And I've got a good example as to why it's so important not to just run to the cheapest one if you're able to. So I had somebody that I was insuring for income protection. And for them, and because of their amount of cover that they needed in different circumstances, their guaranteed premium each month was £120 a month for their income. Now, that was guaranteed. I then had guaranteed age costed, and that started at £75 per month. Now, naturally, any of us are going to look at that and go, I would quite like the £75 a month option, please. That's a lot nicer, you know, brilliant. But the important thing is then to look at the long-term thing. And that's when an advisor really comes into play, like myself. So £120 a month guaranteed is more money now. £75 a month is cheaper now, but a lot more money in the long run. Because when you looked at it and you looked at the premiums over the entire time from setting it up to retirement age, the cheaper one now was £90,000 more expensive than the other one.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And that's £90,000 more expensive. So the cheap option. The cheap option is £90,000 more expensive.
Yes. Because especially by the time you're getting towards on the age costed ones, when you're starting to get towards the age of your late 40s, the 50s, the premiums are massively jumping up. And they are going to get to a point where, to be honest, at some point you won't have paid £90,000. Because you will have had to probably cancel the policy a lot earlier than that, because we're going to go from £75. And once you are getting older, it's not going to be too long before you're well over £300 a month for the premiums. So that's the thing. So for a long time, the guaranteed, you know, age costed is going to look really nice. But those years when you really need it kicking in, probably most likely reasons for it kicking in, it's going to get to a point when it's unaffordable. Now, I say all that, there are some absolutely amazing options with guaranteed age costed. So I don't want to say that never to go for them. For some people, it does come down to affordability. Somebody might look at what we've just said as that example and go, that's all well and good, Catherine, but I can't afford £120 right now, but I can afford £75. That's fine. If that's what needs to be done, then you go for the £75 a month option. It's just knowing those differences. And there's also, well, sometimes some people's occupations mean that they are ridiculously expensive. I mean, silly expensive with a guaranteed premium. But on the guaranteed age costed, because they usually sit within different types of insurer, that they actually end up being really, really cheap in comparison. So there are absolutely places where these are important. But if you are somebody who doesn't really have anything that's going to come up in the application that could have influenced the outcomes, and even sometimes then it's fine, but it's usually to do with the occupation. If you've just got quite a straightforward, not risky occupation, then really you should be ideally being able to go for sort of like the guaranteed options. And
all
occupation
right.
is a completely different ballgame that we can go into as well if you want to.
All right, can I jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
Because as I listen to you talk, you're doing a great job of explaining it to me. And like, but I've got like 25 years experience in financial services. Right. So I'm imagining the listeners are sitting there going, okay, there's four kind of premiums.
Absolutely.
It's my occupation and it's how long do I want to have you? I thought, can we just for a second, can I ask you to do something for me, Catherine? Because you've got a really good analogy you
yes.
use for conceptually getting across the idea of income protection.
Okay.
I think if you could just share that with the listeners, I think they're going to be like, oh, okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a really good example. And I have to say, I've taken this, like, in a sense, somebody else sort of like said this to me and I've taken it and sort of like made it my own in the way that I describe it, if that's okay. So the reason for income protection is basically, if you think about everything that you have and want and do in life, it's linked to money, which is a really kind of, it's quite a sad thing in many ways that it is, but it is. You want to eat, you want to have a house over your head, you want water, you want clothes. It's all to do with money. And ultimately, we do lots of insurances. Like lots of people have pet insurance. And you're kind of like, okay, if you're insuring your pets, you know, you're more important than your pets. I know not everybody will necessarily think that. I might get hate mail from saying that. However, you know, it is the kind of thing of we are, you know, our pets rely on us and our money. So we need to pay their insurance. We need to make sure our money's okay. So a good way of describing it is that imagine that you have a cash point in your garden, front garden. And once a month, your income comes out of that cash point. If you don't get your cash at that exact point, that's it. There's no other money coming in. You're going to have no idea what you're going to have to do, basically. And it comes down to that thing about what would you do? If you don't think of it as yourself, what would you do to protect that cash point? And just be really mindful to sort of really think, right, that's it. There's just no other money unless I'm there on the last Friday of the month at 9 o'clock, when that money's going to come firing out, you know, like one of those toy things where it just goes at you. Right, I'm going to need to grab it and run into the house. Now, what would you do to protect that? Now, in my point of view, if it was me and we were all in this kind of thing, in this kind of society where it was like that, I always kind of think of like, right, well, I would have it, I'd build a box around it, which has like, you know, retinal scanning, key codes, maybe some kind of electricity wires. I'd have my husband there with a baseball bat kind of thing, just ready as a just in case. You'd watch everything, wouldn't you? You'd be looking for everybody like a hawk because you'd be so worried that you wouldn't get your money that you need to live on. It is, everything is so essential upon it. So if you had that cash machine in your front garden and you would do, maybe not exactly to the same extent as me, but something similarly to protect that money coming out of there, what you need to do is think, actually, that's my body. In a sense, I am the cash point. And I need to know that if something happens, which means I cannot work, because I think another thing as well is people often go, well, I've got statutory sick pay. Now, statutory sick pay is, I can't remember the figure off the top of my head exactly. I did do it recently, but I just can't remember. But it means for 28 weeks, so for that 6.5 months, if you could just get statutory sick pay, you have to live off roughly £2,800 for 6.5 months. That's it. And people don't think that, you know, we hear, you know, statutory sick pay. Oh, I'll be fine. I've got statutory sick pay. We obviously know that there are things like disability benefits in the UK, but they are incredibly hard to get. I mean, some people might debate that, but they are very, very hard to get and to keep as well going forward because they are assessed. And if you are in a situation where you cannot work again, the last thing that you really want to be having to do is fight for those kinds of benefits. And even if you do get them, they are not going to enable you to live and maintain your standard of living that you have right now. And I know, obviously, Julie, you do lots and lots in this space. You'll be talking about pensions at times, investments. if you are somebody who is so minded that you want to make sure that your future is fine because you want to make sure your pensions even, your pensions and your investments are going to look after you, the thing that funds those things is your income. And what funds your income is you and your body and your mind. And the way to protect that is income protection.
That's an awesome explanation. Just for the record, I'm building an underground bunker. And I am putting the cash machine in the underground bunker. I don't need the dramatic razor wire, like electrified fence, Catherine. You have a very, very vivid imagination, which is a little bit troubling, but... Michelle, how are you protecting your cash machine?
I don't know. I've got to think of something even more, you know, imaginative now. So let me have a think about it and I'll come back to you.
Right. So, Catherine, that's a really good overview. And you've started to give us an idea of the complexity that's involved with it's almost like all the different levers we can pull with this kind of plan to tailor it. So I'm just wondering then, like, obviously our listeners tend to be women. We know we've got the odd man out there. Thank you very much for listening. Is it a little bit more complicated for women because we have career breaks? Our income can fluctuate a bit more than men. So I'm thinking about, you know, if we take time off to raise children or to look after family members, or we just decide to go part-time. So our career and our earnings tend not to be linear the same way that men's are.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's other things to consider about women as well in the income protection space that I'll go into. So there are certain policies that there's certain policies you can arrange while you're on maternity leave even. Sort of potentially in preemption for you coming back. If you are on maternity leave, you know, your policy will just stay active with quite a few insurers, but it is always best to chat to them and just say, right, this is what's happening. Am I still protected? What would happen in the event of a claim, and just making sure that that's okay. In terms of working like reduced hours, that is usually fine. The only thing is that with some insurers and some policies, you need to work at least 16 hours to be able to have the insurance. So as long as you're working more than 16 hours with the majority of insurers, you should be able to get income protection. And there are as well certain things about some policies will come with what's known, I'm so sorry for the technical wording again, but a guaranteed insurability option. So that means that if something certain happens, like certain life circumstances, like your mortgage increases or your salary increases, which, you know, could well happen on maternity, something happens and your job suddenly go, you know, all this kind of thing, that you can get up to a certain amount. They'll just, in a sense, they'll say, right, this has increased or this has happened. We're prepared to increase your income protection by this much. So that's really, really positive to know. I mean, it's a really key thing as well, is not to make, if you already have income protection in place, don't make knee-jerk reactions thinking, oh, well, this has happened, so it's just not valid anymore. Do speak to an advisor, because we do see stuff like this happen quite a bit. And what you do need to be careful of is that if something happened health-wise over time that you didn't have originally, you might want to keep that original policy in place because a new one might have an exclusion. And this is the other thing about women and income protection. And we're trying to do quite a lot of work on this in my company because it's definitely an area that we've seen quite a few issues on. So the main areas for claim in income protection are mental health and, a lovely word, musculoskeletal conditions. So basically things like back pain. That tends to be the two main claim areas. And what insurers are quite conscious of is that if somebody already has those things, it can sometimes lead to an exclusion on the policy for claims relating to that condition. Now, some people can feel quite annoyed about that or frustrated about that. So I sometimes use an example that I think hopefully makes it a bit easier to understand. I mean, I don't particularly like it myself that they're there, but from an insurer point of view and a risk point of view, if we took Parkinson's, and I always like to go to this, my dad has Parkinson's, so I just always think it's a nice one for me to just, I can really envisage it. If somebody had Parkinson's and they were to take out income protection, we probably would assume that the policy wouldn't pay out for something related to Parkinson's because they could start the policy one day and claim the next day, which just doesn't work. It would just be financially that all the insurance companies would just go immediately bust if everybody was able to do that. So it's kind of the same with mental health and back pain. We used to have it where any kind of level of mental health meant that there would be a mental health exclusion, and same with back pain, and it would just be forever. Whereas now insurers are starting to change things, which is really positive. So we are starting to see sometimes a case of, right, well, actually, you know, this person, there was some stress, very understandable stress to a situation 3 or 4 years ago. So actually, we won't put on a mental health exclusion. Maybe at the moment we're talking in this month, it could be like in 3 months' time from now or something. They may say, right, you know, once we get to actually 5, 4 years and there's been no mental health, we won't need to put an exclusion on there. I'm talking very randomly here with numbers and time frames just to try and give examples. But with women, a key area that we have, or a few key areas that we have that can be a real difficulty is for women who've had children, specifically because once you have the mainstream income protection, we tend to, I kind of call it again a baseball bat analogy here, we kind of say three strikes and you're out kind of thing. Three exclusions and you don't tend to get the income protection policy on the mainstream. So with a woman, she's maybe had some postnatal depression. She's got back pain because she's been looking around a kid for a good 3 years or so. There may be something else. There may be a family history of something that she doesn't have, but a family history of something that each of those individually isn't like, it wouldn't stop her having income protection. But because there's three things, it means a lot of the mainstream insurers would decline the income protection. Now, we're doing quite a lot of work on this because it does feel like it shouldn't be like that. And I do understand, in, you know, from an underwriter's point of view, so the underwriter is the person who makes the decision and they work for the insurer, that, you know, they're seeing at least two things there that are two of the biggest claim areas on this policy. And what the insurers tend to say is, well, if we've excluded the two main areas that people would claim on, is the policy worth it? Now, what we need is lots and lots of people to go, I would still really love this because I could still develop Parkinson's. I could still have a stroke, which means I could never work again. I could develop multiple sclerosis. That's quite a thing that's getting diagnosed.
Can I ask you a question here then? Because I've had this situation with a client because there was three things.
Yes.
So the providers are refusing to insure because they don't believe their policy offers enough value to the person that's applying for it.
If they've taken out the at least the two main claim areas, which I say back pain and mental health make up a significant majority of income protection claims, they will think, is this even, in a sense, is it worth it? Because we've took out so much, in a sense, that the two main areas that you're likely to claim on aren't there anymore.
So this is almost like the providers trying to do the decent thing.
It's
misguided, really, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's really bizarre, but that is it.
Whoa,
that is the reason. And that's similarly why we have such an issue at times with diabetes. So going over to a different product slightly, but diabetes and critical illness cover, especially type 1 diabetics, because with type 1 diabetics, there is an enhanced risk of, unfortunately, stroke, heart attack, and some cancers. So that's your three main claim areas on a critical illness policy. Again, a significant proportion of the claims are those three areas. So that's why we have such difficulty insuring people with type 1 diabetes for critical illness cover, because the insurers say, well, the likelihood of what you will develop or anybody will develop is this, and you're quite at heightened risk, which means we can't cover those things. It's, you know, potentially it's even marginally affordable pricing without being absolutely ridiculously expensive. So we can't do it. That's not to say that we can't insure people with type 1 diabetes with critical illness cover. It's just we really need to know where to go. But that's what we see with a lot of the mainstream insurers. But then you also have a lot of what's known as the friendlies. So the friendlies are literally a lot of the mutual societies that work in the income protection space. And I'm sorry, listeners, but it is just blanket terms.
Right. Can we just clarify for a minute here? Okay, so you get what's known as friendly societies, which are mutual companies, which means they don't have shareholders. It's not that we think they're particularly warm and cuddly and approachable companies. That's not what Catherine meant. Although they may be.
A lot of them are very friendly. And yeah, I'm sure. One of them, one of the people who works in one of the insurers, her mum knits lots of teddy bears and she gives them out different places at different events that she attends. And she's just, so you have like a little teddy bear. It's gorgeous, wonderful things. Mum's 93 and she just knits away for us all. Anyway, so, you know, they are really good. And what they tend to have more option though. So if somebody has had a lot more than three things, they tend to potentially have more options to cover. Because another thing as well with women, And I don't know if I mentioned this in the last one or not, but I'll just mention it again just in case. Menopause can potentially be something that's tricky. Now, for a woman who's going to go direct online, answer all the questions truthfully, as she would do with menopause symptoms, she might have a mental health exclusion on the policy. Sometimes it is a matter of going direct. And the reason I say mental health exclusion is some women, instead of taking HRT, they choose to take antidepressants. So as soon as it's an antidepressant that's been took, there is kind of an assumption that there's a mental health condition there, or that the mental, because they've chosen antidepressants, that there is some kind of symptoms of anxiety or stress, which we all, you know, it's very natural at times to feel anxious and stressed. It's a completely normal human emotion to feel that. Obviously, it can be more heightened when we're going through menopause. And it is really a matter of trying to speak directly to underwriters to say to them, this is menopause.
Oh, that's interesting, because some GPs will prescribe antidepressants because they believe it can help with hot flushes.
Yes.
So it's not even anything anxiety or mental health related.
Yeah, absolutely. And other conditions as well. So autism sometimes, or not autism, sorry, hypermobility syndrome. So I have hypermobility syndrome. So sometimes antidepressants are diagnosed with musculoskeletal conditions because they have a certain pain aspects to them as well.
Yeah, I've had amitriptyline for sciatica.
Exactly. So it's not, and it depends upon the question set. Because
right.
If you said sciatica and it says, have you had medication? And you'd say, yes. And, you know, it could well be, I have to say with sciatica, that they may say, when were your last symptoms? Right, okay, exclusion for sciatica on the claim. But if you didn't have any of that and you just had, because menopause doesn't come up in any of the question set, but there would be a question saying, have you been prescribed any medication in the last 3 years or 3 months potentially that's ongoing? And you'd say yes, and they'd say, well, what's it for? And you'd maybe put in menopause, that'd be fine. But then it might potentially lead to other questions. And sometimes, you know, if you need to put in there that it's an actual antidepressant, we can sometimes end up with that. So just be very mindful of that. What you sometimes see online or direct with insurers yourself, it can be a very different outcome if you use an advisor. And as well, sometimes we have different question sets. So what the insurers put out to the public, sometimes question-wise, sometimes different to what an advisor will see.
Well, we have a lot of fun running the cafe. The reason we do it is to reach as many women as possible to empower them around money. So if you know a woman who would benefit from feeling financially empowered, you can help them and us by sharing this episode with them. So Michelle, as Catherine's sharing all her information and knowledge on income protection, bloody hell, Catherine, is there anything you don't know? You're brilliant. Michelle, is there anything that you wanted to ask while we've got the expert with us?
No, I think it's really interesting what you're saying about sort of underwriting, because I've had a few clients where you go through questions for things and what that might trigger and actually how they view those when you said about the two issues, and then they say, well, actually, as you say, I've got many clients who go, well, actually, I'd still like to be covered for everything else.
Yeah.
And I think for me, that was one of the biggest, because I didn't realise that. You know, I've had clients where they said, we won't, you know, accept you, or, and then you go and look elsewhere. And I guess all insurers must have their own criteria. Is that right for underwriting? They all have different criteria.
Yeah, so they have what's known as their own underwriting philosophies. And it's really interesting in the insurance market. And I didn't know this until I started advising, but we all know the insurers. So we all know your big name companies. You know, if you think about it, you know, sort of like if you go online and do sort of like an online comparison site, there's lots and lots of big names that we're all very familiar with. What a lot of people don't realize is that there are insurers of the insurers. So insurers are one level, and then what we have above them is what's known as reinsurers. So the reinsurers are the ones that absolutely, they set certain things and then the insurers set certain things. So the reinsurers will be saying, right, they've got all these people known as actuaries who look at incredible amounts of numbers and data, decades worth of health data to make their decisions. And they will look at it and they'll go, right, in this situation, we're prepared to say that we will be prepared to look at someone in this situation at standard rates, or potentially, you know, they would probably need to have what's known as a rating, which could be an exclusion, it could be a premium increase on the policy. Or there'll be some people as well that say, we cannot insure this person. It is unusual to get someone who can't be insured anywhere, but there are times, but it is phenomenally rare to actually have that situation. So they have the reinsurers. So the reinsurers set what's known as their underwriting manuals and guides, which the insurers then use. So then the insurers will then set their own philosophy, because what they're doing is they're kind of going, well, the insurers are saying, right, well, we'll take on 60% of the risk, and the reinsurer will take on like 40% of the risk for each client that we have. And what can make it very, very tricky is that the insurers use different reinsurers, but then they might also use different reinsurers per product type. So you might have that they have their life and critical illness with one reinsurer, their income protection with another one. And you're like, well, how can you be so good for income protection with this condition, but you're not, I'm not seeing the positive for the life and critical illness. And you're kind of like, is it something about the health that I need to learn more about and understand for the future? And it can sometimes be because it's a different reinsurer, and it's like, fair enough then. And so you're like, right. And you're trying to figure out, right, where does that reinsurer sit? Who uses them? Where can I go for, you know, for the life and critical illness kind of thing? And you're trying to figure all that out. So they will have their own decisions. And what's really interesting is with the way that the insurers do their manuals is that they are reviewed quite a bit. And they will change. And it's known as what's known as the insurer's risk appetite, as to what they will and won't want to insure. And it does flow, but you'll find that some insurers will be incredible for people that have a higher BMI, and then some aren't great. And then you'll find some are brilliant with mental health or certain mental health conditions, but really bad with some mental health conditions, whereas someone over here might be brilliant for those other ones, but not as good as. And so they all kind of take a slightly different place. And there's nowhere to say, this is what this one is doing at this time, because it's all obviously internal decisions. And as an advisor, you do get used to it. You know which ones are going to be good for certain situations. But overall, I think it's really important as well to say here, just again, because thinking about the women's side of things, so the main thing women's side is, you know, there are some health conditions that are very women-based. But generally, I think it's important to say that due to a certain directive quite a few years ago now, men and women pay the same price for their insurance policies. So they're not allowed. So if a man was and a woman are there, they're both the same age, neither of them are smokers, same BMI, absolutely everything about them is the same. They're wanting the same amount of insurance. The price would be exactly the same. It used to be different. So it used to be that men paid more for life insurance, women paid less, and that women paid more for income protection, and that men paid less, but they've made it all equal now. So in terms of equality, that is obviously a good move. The only problem is that men paid more for life insurance, women paid less, so the women became more expensive. And in income protection, the women paid more, the men paid less, so the men came up. So it kind of like, it worked out and it didn't at the same time. But yeah, they definitely have their own different things. So I work very much with my company, helps people who are, a lot of the time, people who have found it difficult to get insurance. Now, it could be that they've been declined insurance. It could be that they've had ratings or exclusions that have just made it not possible for them. And it literally can go from being, they've gone somewhere, maybe direct, or they maybe have even used another advisor at some point, and they've been declined. And actually, you can get them standard rates elsewhere. It's just knowing which questions and which insurer to go for. The only other thing for me to mention, I said occupation. Occupation is a really interesting one, and I don't want to do stereotypes, but I'm going to do slight stereotypes, if that's okay. Please forgive me, women, but I'm going to do it. Okay. So with income protection, there are four occupation classes. Number one, not seen as any risk. Number four, super risky. Women can fall under any of these areas. And the risk rating of those things is all to do about, It's not necessarily the job, it can be, but it's all about if something happens to you physically or mentally, could you still do that job? So let's think of some examples. So number one, let's say an admin person would be class one. Likelihood is you've broken your leg. You're probably still going to be able to do the admin work. You've broken your arm, you're going to need to take some time off, but it's not going to probably be a long, long time off. You know, it's going to be short-lived. Number two, now this often entertains people when I say this one, nail technicians. Nail technicians are seen as more risky because it doesn't take much for one of these fingers, to suddenly have something happen to them, which means it would be more difficult for you to do your job.
That's interesting, because I'm going straight in at skydiving as high risk. And you're like, oh no, nail technician. I'm like, oh, I'm thinking about this all wrong.
You'd be surprised with skydiving as an occupation. You'll be very surprised with that versus as a hobby. It's much, basically, skydiving as an occupation with a few insurances, I'm not talking about income protection, life and kick. Skydiving as an occupation is pretty much, you can potentially do it straight through and not have any issues. But if it's a hobby, that's different and it will be rated.
So if I'm a skydiving instructor, I'm presumably much better at skydiving than somebody that does it as a hobby.
Theory, yes, but you are doing significantly more dives.
That's true.
But the majority of insurers wouldn't do that. It's just knowing where to look.
All right.
So we're going back. So number one, admin. Number two, nail technician. Number three, and this does get people giggling again, yoga instructor. Because they are incredibly fit. Incredibly. I have a Pilates instructor, and honestly, the things that she does with her body, I'm just like, wow, you know, it's incredible what they can do. But if something happens to them, it doesn't take much for them. You know, admin person has a horrendous cold, really horrendous cold. You know, they can probably still keep doing their thing. And I know we're not talking a four-week thing here. Okay. But a yoga person, if they get a horrendous cold, they're not doing their job. They're not able to deliver their class. If they've broken their leg, they're probably going to need to do quite a bit of rehabilitation, because they're going to need to get themselves back up to that fitness to be able to deliver their class. Because it's not necessarily just their own body as well. When you're an instructor, you might be manhandling some other people as well. So you need to be able to be safe to manhandle other people. And then number four, cleaners. Cleaners are seen as a class four occupation because of the risk of you not being able to do your job. Because can you remember one of the big claim areas?
Oh, back.
Back pain.
Mm.
So with each of them, we're talking, what's the likelihood of mental health? What's the likelihood of back pain, the risks? What's the likelihood of, if that person has that they can't carry on? So you often find teachers, chefs, they're quite high up on the list as well. Very high stressful jobs, more likely on a mental health claim. So there's just some examples of how occupations, because again, you think skydiving, you're thinking bomb disposal experts, you're thinking all these things, you know, where, and true, they are absolutely seen as, you know, quite high risk, but it doesn't take much for a more stereotypically female job to actually go quite high in those ratings.
That's really interesting, Catherine. I hadn't put those two things together at all.
It's a lot of people don't. That's the, you know, and it's just because I do training on this. It's sort of like it sticks in my mind. But yeah, and then that absolutely will determine as well the insurer that you need to go to.
All right. Now, I've got another question for you. As I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking about situations I've come across in the past and situations I've been in as well. Is, so let's say I've listened to the podcast and like, okay, this income protection stuff's really cool. I'm going to go out and get me some.
Yeah.
So I go out, I find someone that knows what they're doing, who knows which levers to pull, and I end up with the right policy. Now, today, when I take it out, I'm on £50,000 a year.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So I've been insured for as much as possible. Then 5 years down the line, I decide that I want to go part-time. Mm-hmm. So now I am in the position of being over-insured.
Yes.
So let's say that in those 5 years, I've had some health issues as well.
Yeah.
So I want to keep hold of my plan, because the chances are if I go somewhere else, I'm going to get rated or excluded or refused.
Yes.
So can I approach my existing provider and ask them to reduce the cover?
Yes, they will do. They'll reduce the cover and they will reduce the premium in line with how much they reduce. I don't know the exact calculations for reducing the premium in that situation, but insurers are generally happy to reduce their risk. You know,
right, so in theory, that's possible. Yeah, and if I've got the guaranteed insurability option and something happens in the future that means that my earnings go back up and it takes one of those guaranteed insurability options, then I can get my original and a more appropriate level of cover then.
It's if you've gone from 50,000, let's say you went from 50,000 to 25,000, even with a guaranteed insurability option, you're not within that allowance that they allow for that. You're not going to get back up to 50,000. It's too much of a jump.
Right.
I did something. I've been looking at it for somebody recently, and they were able to increase their income as long as they had at least a 10% increase in their salary. But that was still capped in a sense. They were saying, as long as you've increased your salary by 10%, we can look at potentially doing this, but it would be a maximum of this much. So it really does depend upon what you are wanting to do and how long you're planning on it for as well.
Right.
So if we take a bit of a random example, if that's okay. So let's say somebody took out their policy 5 years ago and they're planning on going part-time for a year. Let's just say, but don't know why they would, but let's just say they were going part-time for a year. So they're going from 50 down to 25,000. But during that time, that last 5 years, they have had some depression. Now, what we might do is have a conversation to say, right, well, we can do this, but at the end of the, at the end of this year, I mean, you might be able to take sabbatical leave with it. So just, again, don't rush to things. But if you did specifically want to do that, just have a think, because you're not guaranteed to necessarily get back to 50,000. And if you needed to top up with another policy, you wouldn't replace the original, because that doesn't have the mental health exclusion. You would top up with the second one. You would have a mental health exclusion on it. So it's sometimes it is worth going, you know what, I'm paying for 50,000. I know I can't get it right now, but in a year or two, I will be back to that amount. Is it worthwhile me just carrying on paying for it as it is? That's really debatable. And it's a huge individual decision. And I would say, really, it's definitely one to really think about if you have developed something which could be an exclusion. But then at the same point, anything can happen to anybody, with any of these things. There's certainly times where we've tried to do insurances for people, and it's that whole thing. We've all experienced it as advisors, and like, oh, well, I'll think about it. And they come back in a couple of months, oh, I really do need to set this up now because I've just been told I've got this. And you're like, unfortunately, that means it's changed things. Your price has gone up, or there's now an exclusion. And that's really, really hard to see, because it's somebody that you've gotten to know and you want them to put something in place. And I get frustrated sometimes when I see, because on social media as well, I see advisors saying things like, oh, well, if you've done a good job, they all walk away with everything the first time you've spoken to them, kind of thing. And I get really frustrated with that, because all that, everybody can afford, life insurance, critical illness, and income protection. And I think sometimes people, as advisors, they're not sometimes in the reality of the fact that sometimes £5 a month is too much for people, even if we need to make sure that we're making it affordable for people, and especially for the long term. But if you do have a policy and something's changing and you think you need to change it, it is always a good idea to get advice, because a lot of the time with the advice, you can often still keep something and it'd be worthwhile, rather than just having to completely shut it all down. And again, there's been times that people have come to me and said, well, I've closed this down because this happened. And I'm like, get that set back up right now. I'm just like, we're not messing about. We'll have a nice chat. I can't do anything for you right now, in a sense. So I can do stuff, but it's not exactly what you want. You need that policy setting back up. And that's what needs to happen.
I've got another question. This one's for a friend.
Okay.
I.e. me.
Okay. Right. I was thinking, have I got a bit of an eyebrow move there?
gave the game away there, right? So I've got income protection. And I have those two common exclusions on it. I've got exclusion for mental health and exclusion for back, because I've confessed to the sciatica, haven't I? I haven't been to the doctor, haven't had any treatment, haven't been on any medication for about 10 years.
Yeah.
So might it be an option that I go back out to the market?
Absolutely.
And try again and get a policy that doesn't have those exclusions. And is there a case for me going to my existing insurer and going, hello, hello?
You can sometimes, but I was going to say, with exclusions, as an advisor, one of the things that we always try and do is say to them, can you make this reviewable, this exclusion? Because sometimes if there's an exclusion, it's just a case of an exclusion, that's it. So we do sometimes say, want to make it reviewable. And we can try and push for that. We don't always get it. So a lot of the time, if there's an exclusion on there, it's on there. But it is always worth asking. And what I would say is, if you've not had any symptoms of back pain and things like that, depending upon, sometimes it comes down to occupation as well. But, you know, sometimes if we're maybe 5 years since any kind of symptoms.
Am I a high-risk occupation, Catherine?
As a financial advisor, you are class two.
Okay.
Okay. So anybody who works in the advice space is seen as a class two occupation.
Right.
And that is to do with stress.
I was guessing it was the mental health one.
It is the mental health. But also as well, there is a little bit of a musculoskeletal thing in it because we're often sat at our desks. We're not moving around much during the day. What's that kind of doing to our bodies long term? Things like that. But it is usually to do more like with the fact that we're in pressure environments and things like that. Well, a lot of people are. So always worth asking. And yeah, if you've got about, you know, with the mental health, it just depends sometimes. So like if it's been a bit of bereavement that's not lasted long, if it has been a stress situation, which was incredibly reactive to a situation that it would be feasible that anybody would have been stressed during that time, then, you know, we may be a couple of years, you know, we can maybe be going, okay, you know, we can maybe see if there's not going to be a mental health exclusion on this. But it really, really does depend upon the individual. And I do work very specifically with people in the mental health space. And I think what's important to know is that there's lots of aspects to mental health, as with anybody with mental health will know, and any single one of those can change the decision. And sometimes as well, it's not the questions that we see on the insurance applications aren't always everything the insurer wants to know. So when you speak with an advisor, they should ideally be asking you quite a lot of questions, only things relevant to the policy, never anything that's irrelevant, because that would be obviously completely wrong. But you might sometimes, like, especially if people speak to me, I will ask them questions that aren't on the insurance policy because I'm looking for the things that might end up the insurers wanting to know about it, just so I can double check from the start, like any kind of background questions or follow-up questions that might come.
That's because you're like a ninja at this stuff.
The mental health side of things, absolutely.
You're a ninja.
Come on, we've got a list. Yes or no?
All right, Michelle, is there anything that you would like to ask Catherine?
Just taking it all in, because actually, on it, you know, slightly different. I've just actually set up a critical illness policy for me. My next move is my income protection, which I had problems with because I'd had a few hospital visits really well. But it's just interesting to see, you know, how it's done. And I think for anyone out there who, I've had friends who said to me, I've tried to get insurance and I've been, you know, declined, so I'm never going to get it. Actually, just to get people to go and speak to other insurers, go and speak to an advisor and actually see what else is out there, that it isn't just that one insurer that's making the decision on everything. There is possibilities people can go and explore either on their own or with an advisor if things are slightly more difficult. You know, I'm an advisor, I've just done mine and I've got an exclusion on my critical illness. I had a feeling that was coming, I knew. And I, you know, I think I would in sort of 4 or 5 years' time go back and revisit that. But it's just really interesting, people, because I've had so many clients even say to me, don't even look at that. I've been declined before, so let's just leave it.
Yeah, you do get that. And I think, you know, as I say, we generally help people who've had been in that situation. And I think we get a real mix. The majority of people I speak to are just so desperate to get something, and they're so eager to wanting to get something that they're prepared to do it. And then you do get some people who are just like, well, there's just no point, I can't. And then there's others who are just downright angry. You know, they're really ticked off at the insurance world. And every single one of them is such a different approach that you need to take to support them. And I think in terms of, you know, people saying declines, you know, and things, what I do as me as an advisor, and this obviously comes down to my personality, is I just generally say to people, well, I'm looking, you know, kind of thing. You know, you say you don't want this, that's fine. But for me, for my compliance, for my company, I am going to be looking and I will be saying to you, right, based upon your circumstances, this could be possible and it might have an exclusion. You might say, right, well, it's not possible for me because I'm going to have an exclusion. It's like, well, I'm going to have a look. Yes, there is an exclusion. That doesn't mean the policy is not possible. It just means it doesn't fit what that person feels is right. But I've still done my job and I've still said to them, this is what is going to happen. I will be showing you options. You then pick and choose what's right for you.
I think one thing I struggle with when we talk about insurance is people, and I explain to clients every day, and you know, we put it in place for ourselves. We legally have to insure a car.
Yeah.
So we have a car outside and we legally have to insure that car. And if we don't, we can be prosecuted. you go to court. I don't actually understand the mindset of why we don't have something there that makes us trigger and go, actually, let's insure ourselves. We insure that car that's outside that may be worth, you know, for some people, £500, other people worth tens of thousands of pounds. Why would we not do that?
It's silly, isn't it? There is quite a bit of space. There's quite a lot of discussion at the moment. So I work in quite a few areas of protection. So personal, which is like what you've done, Michelle, which is setting up a policy for yourself, for your own life. I work in business, which is where the policies are set up through a company. And I also work on something as a group space, which is also company-based, but it's where you insure a group of individuals. So like the majority of the employees in a thing, in a company. And there is quite a bit of discussion at the moment about whether or not, and most people would know this as death in service cover. And they would probably recognise that as maybe an employee perk or enhanced sick pay, which would be group income protection. And there are lots of debates happening, especially with trade bodies in our industry and governments, as to whether or not things like death and service cover should become, this actually needs to happen. You know, companies can't just, in a sense, pick and choose that maybe...
Make it
kind of statutory. And there's pros and cons to that. So we wouldn't just all just rush into that straight away. I absolutely adore that kind of cover. I have it in my own company. I recommend and advise people to have it. So it is just a matter of, you know, sort of knowing where to look. But as you say, it's that mindset of sometimes, because it is, for me, sometimes it's the mindset of that thing of like, well, I'm going to insure my pet, which legally we don't need to do, you know, but I'm going to insure my pet. Because if they need to have an operation, it's going to cost me £5,000. But we don't insure ourselves and go, but that would be a £30,000 loss each year if I don't insure myself.
I think a lot of this comes down to trust. And I don't mean in the obvious way we don't trust insurance companies. But it's just like pet insurance is fairly straightforward and simple to organise and put in place. Yeah. We've just had to talk like 45 minutes explaining income protection. So it is complex, and that makes it harder to be able to trust it, because when we don't understand something, that's a big barrier to get over, isn't it?
It is. And that's why, I mean, in terms of the, in the protection insurance world, you have life insurance, Chris can ask about, and income protection. Any other insurance sits within general insurance, the kind of different departments of the insurance world. And with life insurance is the most sold out of anything.
Because it's simple.
It's simple because, and also it's simple to understand because it's a case of there's not much debate when it comes to a claim. You're either dead or you're not, you know, kind of thing. It's pretty straightforward. There can be debates, but the majority of the time there isn't debates. Critical illness cover, that is often combined with life insurance. It kind of naturally fits on. Plus, also, it's got those main things in there. The majority of the time, people are really worried about cancer. Critical illness cover, it stands out. It's usually at least 50 conditions, and you've got cancer in there. People automatically tend to go to that. Most people have had somebody that they know who's had the condition and not had a pleasant time. So, you know, it kind of all fits in quite nicely. Income protection is the lowest, is the most undersold out of all of them. And that comes down to a mixture of things. It does come to the fact that if you're not an advisor, it's beautiful how much you can tweak it, because it means that actually you can find that more people can be insured for income protection than critical illness cover, because there's so many different options. But that's the thing, there's so many options. If you don't understand it, I'm really big on the idea of trying to get this into the schools and things like that, and just trying to explain to people, right, you need to, if you give me this little bit of money, I'll protect you for all this money. Does that sound good? You know, obviously kids are going to go, yeah, you know, absolutely, they're going to do it. So let's get it to them at a really, really young age. But again, with critical illness cover, it's quite simple. You've got 50 conditions there. You either have it core or enhanced. So you get like the main version or the extra special with sparkles on top version. And that's it. Whereas with income protection, as we already said, I think there's like at least 5 different things that we need to think about and consider and things like that. But essentially, if you are going to go and do an income protection quotation for yourself, what I would be suggesting is that you go for the maximum amount to start off with, go for the maximum amount that you can insure yourself each month. Go to your state pension age, which for a lot of people around their 20s, 30s now is around the age of 68. It might be 67 for some people who are older, but we're around 68-ish. You want it. There'll be something in there called the deferred period. And that's what I was, again, the jargon, that's what I was saying before about how long you need to be ill before the financial side kicks in, because there's lots of stuff that can happen before the money kicks in that can provide you a lot of support otherwise than that. Now, what you need to do is make sure that doesn't clash with your sick pay. So we're not talking statutory sick pay. So if you get 4 weeks full pay and 4 weeks half pay, you don't want your income protection policy to be less, you know, to be paying you before 4 weeks, because the insurer won't pay out. You'll pay for, if you went for a 1 day policy, you'd pay for 1 day because that's what you've chosen, but the insurer won't give you money until 4 weeks because you've already got your income. It's still coming from your employer. So another example is 6 months. You get full 6 months. It's really common in the public sector, especially the NHS. You get six full months sick pay. So you wouldn't want your income protection policy kicking in before 26 weeks. There's a bit of an added complication for NHS sick pay, so I won't go into that though, because it's a bit too technical. But there's just extra things. But again, the shorter it is, the more expensive it is. But just make sure it lines up with your sick pay. If you don't get any sick pay, go for a four-week option and see what that pricing is. The other two things, do it on a guaranteed premium, see what it looks like. Does it feel affordable? And then the last one is make sure how long it's going to pay out for. Some policies, and again, these will look cheaper, will pay out for 1 year per claimable event, 2 years, 5 years per claimable event, or all the way to retirement age. What you ideally want is an all the way to retirement age option. And with those other ones, just to be clear, so I was really clear to say like 2 years per claimable event. So let's say, touch wood, it won't happen, but let's say you had cancer and you were off work for a year and a half, it'll pay for that year and a half until you're back to work. And then the policy will carry on. And the next time you need to make a claim, you would have another 2 years potentially that it would claim for, but it would stop at the 2 year mark. So if you did get something like Parkinson's and it was progressive, it would pay for 2 years, but then it would stop.
All right. No, that's really good. I'm glad you covered that. Oh my God, I can't believe how much information we've covered in sort of such a short space of time, Catherine. That is absolutely brilliant. Michelle, is there anything that you would like to add as we kind of wind things up?
No, I think the only thing I'd like to add is that people explore it. People go and look because it is so important. We give plans to people all the time and it is based on people's income. It's on an assumption that income will carry on for a number of years. So to me, it is one of the most valuable things we can do. So it's just to say to people, go and explore, go and see. And if you do need to, you know, further advice, go and find an advisor that can help you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the big giveaway is if advisors have got it, that's normally a clue that it's quite a good thing to have, right? Absolutely. And I got it years ago and then I let it go. Then I realised what a stupid thing that was. And I went to get some more. But the relief I had when I found that I'd been accepted. Okay, I've got my two exclusions, but the utter relief that I'd managed to get myself some income protection back. I was like, phew. So, yeah. So Catherine, thank you very much for joining us and sharing with us your barbed wire baseball bat analogy of why you need income protection. I don't think you're going to get that on any other podcast, folks. And Michelle, thank you for joining me.
Someone says to me, you know what, you shouldn't really be saying that. And I'm just like, well, I was just nattering.
No, it's perfect. It's created a visual image and everybody's like the cash point in the garden now. So what we want you to do is go away and have a think about the cash point in your garden and ask yourself, what are you going to do to protect it? Thank you to the listeners for listening. And until next time, take care of yourselves. Thanks for listening to the Women and Money Cafe. If you've enjoyed it, please leave us a review. It really does help. And also please note the podcast is for education and information only and doesn't constitute personal financial advice. Please reach out to one of us or any of the other fantastic financial advisors in the UK for that kind of help.